I apologize for whoever listens to this. Just there's been a lot of gum chewing lately. A lot of gum chewing. But I haven't bought a vape for a couple weeks. And I got this nicotine gum. I got a bunch of nicotine gum for free last year. And so I'm doing a lot of gum chewing right now. But yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, leaving reviews. And how it used to be, like, the idea of the critic. Oh, he's a music critic. He's a movie critic. And you think of that as a man. You know, famous critics were often men. But it just seemed like more of a male impulse, too. You know, even just knowing, you know, myself. Like, there was a point in my life where I was like, I could just be a critic. It's probably around like 14, 15 maybe. I don't know, 15 might be a little too old. I feel like this is more of like a 14-year-old thought. But around that age, just thinking like, oh yeah, I could just be a music critic. What a life of hell that would have been. Not just because the idea of being a music critic just means nothing now, but just the idea of doing that. But, you know, that was a career choice, a rare one. You know, not many people become professional music, movie critics, whatever. But I remember just wanting to review things, too. And I had a friend, you know, he went on to be a very successful, like, borderline famous musician. I don't know him anymore, but he was a good friend of mine in junior high, part of high school. And I remember he made a website, and, like, a big part of it was reviews. Movie reviews. That was a pretty common amateur website thing to do. I had one too. I had a website for a brief time, probably my sophomore year of high school, and I just reviewed CDs that I liked. They weren't great reviews, they were probably terrible, but it was something that you just, as a young man, you kind of felt this calling, like, to review things, to be a critic. Both things you liked and things you didn't like. You wanted to say something about them. But then the idea of being like the humorist sort of critic was big too, where you review things that suck. That was a popular part of the early internet, was like, oh, check out what this guy does. He reviews things that suck. But like young men just kind of gravitated toward that. And I don't remember young women doing that as much. I don't remember them having the sort of critic fantasy that a lot of young men had. But interestingly, like, what got me thinking about this is yesterday it just crossed my mind where I was like, oh yeah, a lot of the reviews people leave online now, you know, because we're in this review world where there are all these websites, you know, you review things, you give them ratings, you know, Yelp, Google. That's a big part of it, you know, for any business. Your Google rating, people can just leave a review. Facebook, a lot of reviews, social media is used to review things, to rate things. But you see a lot more women doing it. Like, you're far more likely, I feel like, to see a woman rating and reviewing a restaurant today, or any business, than you are a man. And like working in retail the last year, I see that too. You know, I see it myself. Like the people who give us reviews and things are almost always women. And there's nothing inherently feminine necessarily about what we do, like selling furniture. You know, yeah, like women can be more particular. You know, we get a lot of women where the husband is like, the husband's with her. He's like, she's the one who's going to decide. You know, the woman tends to be more particular. You know, it's homemaking, it's the styles, the colors. Like, a woman will be more particular about that. But there's nothing inherently feminine about furniture. You know, men buy tons of furniture from us, but men are far less likely, whether they have a positive or negative experience, they're far less likely to leave a review. And something I've noticed, too, is women are far more likely to leave a review that's purely rooted in emotion. And I'm not even trying to say, oh, women are more emotional. It's something you actually see in these reviews. You know, when we closed our store temporarily and, like, shut down one of the stores we were running and just made it all furniture, this woman like left a 1-star review and was like, and it was just because she was mad that we closed the old store. It had nothing to do with a positive or negative experience. And obviously she had had a positive experience at the old store, but just out of the principle that we no longer sold the same things that we used to sell, she left us a 1-star review. Like, it was insane, you know? And you can't do anything about that. That's the thing too. It's a lot of power. People have a lot of power to make or break a business with these reviews. But this woman, she gave a negative review. Like, she hadn't even come into the new store, but it was just because, like, we don't sell the same things we used to sell. She wanted to hurt our business, basically. And the words and language she used, it was a purely emotional response. She was upset that the business changed. The business made a decision that has no effect on the customers. You know, as far as, you know, we don't sell some of the things we used to sell, some of the same sort of products. That doesn't, you know, open the door to, like, being evaluated based on that. That's not based on an actual qualitative experience. But you're more likely to see that, too. You know, it's difficult for me to imagine many male customers at this point, like, leaving a review of any kind. Like, even ones who have a very positive experience and shake your hand and thank you, they're just not going to go home and be like, oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to review that place. Oh, that place is great. I'm going to review it. But it's positive and negative. You know, women will be far more likely to leave a positive review. They're just more likely to review, period. And it kind of contrasts with that. I don't know. It's sort of this, I think, a difference between that male tendency to be a critic and this modern tendency for women to be the reviewers. I think some of it, too, has to do with the medium. Where if you were a young man who wanted to be an amateur critic, you know, at least in my age group, the internet was around and you could do that online. But if you did it professionally before that, or even at that same time, you know, your idea was like, I'm going to do this for a publication. I'm going to essentially have a column. It's going to be an article in a publication, in a magazine, in a newspaper, on a website. I might even make my own. I might even make my own zine. I might make my own website. But it was much more yours. You know, it was, you had this sort of proprietary relationship to your reviews. Whereas, like, the current medium is like just these general sites where everybody just leaves little mini reviews all the time. It's just a big list of miscellaneous people leaving reviews. It's not theirs. It's not a collection of their reviews of different things. Like, you can look that up. Like, if you see Google reviews, you can click on someone's name and it'll show you all the reviews they've written, but it's not their site. And how you're going to stumble upon their reviews is just like, oh, what are people saying about this business? Oh, I'm going to go get lunch at this place. How are people reviewing it? You know, and they just see your review among many other people's. It's much more social. And the amateur male critic, what you imagined was like a guy alone in his room watching movies, listening to records. You know, it seemed much more solitary and kind of contained. Like, this is a guy who isolates himself and observes these things that he cares about. And then he gives his thoughts. Spends time alone then, like, writing something out, whether it's meant to be positive, negative, funny, whatever that review is, whatever that, not necessarily criticism, but just a review. Whatever that is, it's very much his. It's self-contained. Whereas, you know, the modern, you know, Google, Yelp, etc. reviews, it's almost like this social activity. you know, it's a bunch of different people weighing in. And that forms, you know, the collective opinion on this thing. You know, even just Amazon reviews are a form of this as well. What's the website where they rate movies, like Rotten Tomatoes? You know, that works that way as well. And that's an interesting one, because I've never looked at it. I don't watch movies ever, really. I stopped regularly watching movies as part of my life probably 20 years ago almost. Of course, I've still seen movies, but I don't really watch movies. It's just not part of my life. So I've never, aside from the only times that I've ever like looked at Rotten Tomatoes or when there's a controversy, like there was that one a little while back where all of the, because what it does is it shows like the critics review, the people who work for Rotten Tomatoes, and then it shows the audience review, the audience score. And there was one where, I think, you know, what it was Dave Chappelle's stand-up. It was some new stand-up he did in the last 5 years. And all the critics were, you know, progressive leftist monsters who gave it a very negative score because it made inappropriate jokes. It made a trans joke or something like that. But the audience reviews were very high. And so it was interesting to see that. Like, at a certain point in time, you know, all you would have gotten were the critic scores. And I don't think critics were as ideologically possessed as they are now. Definitely not the same sort of ideological possession. Like, you didn't, like, listen to Roger Ebert and, what is it, Roger Ebert? Siskel and Ebert. His name is Roger Ebert, but Siskel and Ebert is who I'm thinking of. You know, you didn't listen to Siskel and Ebert and go, oh, there they go, like, They hate everything that's... I mean, maybe they were more political and I just don't know. But it didn't feel as blatant. Whereas now, it's very much just encoded in all of that. And so when those Rotten Tomatoes creatures reviewed it, the people who work for Rotten Tomatoes, they gave it a negative score because they're politically, socio-politically motivated. Whereas the audience was just like, Dave Chappelle's funny or he's not. And they decided he was. And so you saw this contrast where these extremely biased critics were compared to the people. And that's a good thing because you could see, hey, something's up here. But there was a certain point in time, and there's a lot of people who would love it if it still worked this way, where you're only going to get the critic's score. Like, they decide if something sucks or not. And the way it used to feel, like when you read the newspaper movie reviews, it'd be like, oh, this guy really hated, you know, whatever, Independence Day. It must suck. I should use a better example than that. There's a movie I'm trying to think of. What was it? I'm totally blanking on the name of that event. When Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. There was that movie Pearl Harbor, and my friend's dad took me and my friend to go see it in the theater. Like, we went to Japanese food, which was just a pure coincidence. I never even thought about that. Before we saw the movie, we went to a Japanese... There was a Japanese restaurant, like, literally right next to the theater in Kirkland. And so he took us to that Japanese restaurant before we saw Pearl Harbor, which is really fucking funny. I never even thought about that. But then we saw Pearl Harbor, and, like, you know, at that time, like, you went to movies with a very open mind. Like, that's something about, you know, being alive in the 80s and 90s is, like, when you went to go see a movie, like, you really didn't know much about it. You didn't really know what people thought about it or were going to think about it. And so you'd just be like, your friend's dad's like, you guys want to go see Pearl Harbor? And we're like, yeah. And you went in like, I'm going to see a good movie. You gave it the benefit of the doubt. And I do remember watching it and, you know, take like being in the movie, like being invested in what I was watching. But I also feel like that's a shitty movie. And so if someone reviews that, you know, and says like it's a shitty movie. At least back then, like if you saw a review where someone says Pearl Harbor is a shitty movie, you're not going to be like, oh, well, that's because of this. Like, that's because they have this opinion, blah, blah, blah. You just think, oh, it's probably a shitty movie. Or that reviewer just didn't like it. You wouldn't feel like it's getting scored a certain way for political reasons. Obviously, that's always happened. Obviously, that's always happened one way or another. I mean, there's people who were like, you know, ultra patriotic war hawks who would have seen some anti-war movie, some like Vietnam movie that's anti-war, and given it a negative review just for that, for political reasons, regardless of how good it was as a movie. But I don't feel like that was just pervasive. Most movie reviews you're going to see were generally going to be based on like whether that person actually liked the movie or not. But we're in this age now where most of the remaining critics are just servants of social politics. And you see that on something like Rotten Tomatoes, where the audience that's there, the sort of person who's going to watch a Dave Chappelle stand-up special to begin with, is watching it because they're like, oh, he's funny. What is he going to say this time? You know, they're going in with that attitude in most cases. Most people know who he is. You know, he's one of the most famous comedians in the world. Most people are going to go into it being like, oh, he's funny. What's he going to say? Ha. And so, of course, the audience score was high based on that. Whereas these other people, like at Rotten Tomatoes, are like, oh, he makes a trans joke. So their stance is already going to be predefined. You know, it reminds me of an argument I had with somebody some years back. I would say it was about 5 years ago, about the Louis C.K. thing. It wasn't about him specifically. I didn't even bring him up. It was just about sort of the anti-humor element that's just been constant for the last decade. And you know, it was kind of an argument about that. And this woman I know here in Olympia was like, oh, well, like, it's not that. She's like, she brought up Louis C.K. and she's like, well, he didn't even get canceled. This is when, like, you know, the whole Me Too thing had happened and Louis C.K., it came out, was a degenerate pervert. Well, really likes to jack off in front of people is what it came out. No pun intended, but... you know, she was like, well, he didn't even get canceled. The audience just decided that they were tired of edgelord humor like his. And that's what she used, the term edgelord humor, which, like, someone says that, it's like, I'm already not going to have this conversation. But it's like the audience decided that, you know, they were just tired of boring edgelord humor. And they like stuff more like Hannah Gatsby now. And I hadn't even seen Hannah Gatsby at that point. But I was like, that's not even the same audience. Like, how could you... Like, she was basically making the argument that, like, the market decided that Louis C.K. was out and Hannah Gatsby was in. And I said to her, I was like, that's not even the same market. Like, the sort of people who are going to be, you know, Louis C.K. fans aren't going to turn around and be like, oh, we actually like this new thing. Like, the people who make up her crowd, the sort of people who watch her stuff, like, I'm sure there's a little bit of crossover, but that's not the same audience, that's not the same market. Like, your argument is totally bullshit. And what's funny about it, too, is, like, I always thought Louis C.K. was just like a lib comedian. Like, everybody I've ever known who loves Louis C.K. or loved him before the Me Too stuff, they were all libs. And, like, he's funny. Like, I remember some girl made me watch a Louis C.K. special, and I was laughing. You know, like, there were jokes about, you know, just gorging yourself, like, just eating... nonstop, and it was funny. Like, I think his joke was like, it's like, you know, you eat so much, you feel like a fat faggot. Something like that. And I laughed. I laughed out loud. I was like, that's funny. You ever eat so much? You ever, like, just stuff food in your face so much? And then, like, right afterward, you're just like, I feel like a fat faggot. I don't think that's even the exact joke, but it was something similar to that. You know, that was the basic premise. And he did say that word. But I laughed out loud. I was like, that's funny. But most of the people I know were like, dude, Louis C.K., man. Dude, do you watch Louis? So fucking funny, man. Fucking Louis. You know, people I knew who said that, they're generally libs. And, like, when you watch his stand-up, too, like, because I've seen more than one of his specials, like, I feel like a lot of it had that sort of, you know, 90s liberal sort of vibe to it. Like, yeah, he says things that are offensive. Like, he's not, you know, he doesn't hold back necessarily. Like, but I feel like he makes it all very palatable to a liberal audience. It's like, yeah, there's stuff that's shocking, I guess, or edgy, but it's all done in a way that's, like, pretty palatable to liberals. And I feel like, you know, people who would watch The Daily Show would like him or something. You know, not that that's the same kind of humor, but it's just like the same sort of audience. That's how I always viewed it. Same sort of people would be into both those things. So it's funny to me, like, the framework that, like, oh, like, he's just a, you know, an edgelord. And like, the market decided, like, the audience decided they weren't as into that anymore. I'm like, that's not true at all. And that girl I know, that woman I know who said that, you know, she's the sort of person, though, who, you know, if she were a critic, she would be that Rotten Tomatoes critic who rates somebody based on how he aligns with her politics. And a site like Rotten Tomatoes, though, shows you that, though, the difference between that. It shows you that the audience is often going to give a much different score to something like that Dave Chappelle special, which I couldn't even give a shit about. Like, I never even watched it. I don't care. But I, you know, someone's going to give a much different response if they're his audience. Whereas if they didn't have that audience score, the perception might be like, oh, the critics gave it a really bad score. I guess he's just not popular anymore. I guess he just sucks now. You know, and that girl that I was arguing with would say that she would use that as her argument. Like, oh, look, he's getting negative Rotten Tomatoes scores. The audience just decided. The people have spoken. And then it's like, no, but when you actually separate those politically motivated hogs, I don't know why that's the word I'm using, but hogs, politically motivated hogs. It wasn't a very good, not a very good word to use. I should have come up with something better. But when those are the people doing reviews, but you can see, like, what the true audience score is, you can't fall back on bullshit arguments like that. Like, oh, the audience just decided. But I don't know. I mean, and so much humor. You know, I mentioned The Daily Show. Like, another one is John Oliver, and you know, that was sort of that became a lot of the people that I knew. That was, like, their standard for humor. Just, you know, like, making fun of Republicans, like Bush era, you know, liberal humor. Just sort of like, can you believe this dumb thing this Republican said? How could they be so stupid? You know, that sort of humor became really big. And it started to kind of color everything, though. You know, whereas I think that was its own niche at one point, that kind of just became the new standard for humor. Like, everything had to be that way. And, of course, there have always been people who push back on comedy and humor. People are very threatened by it. People are very threatened by, laughter and humor, and even on like a basic primal social level. Not just people who are like, we gotta control the jokes. We gotta make sure the comedians don't talk about that. We gotta make sure that you don't make light of this ever. You gotta make sure that nobody ever finds this funny. Make sure nobody ever says anything clever about this. You know, even beyond that level, you can just see that on an individual level, people are terrified of humor. Terrified of humor at their own expense. You know, people are very paranoid. Like, they, like, if somebody walks by two people and sees them laughing and doesn't know why, the paranoid mind will be like, they're laughing at me. I know they're laughing at me. And sometimes they are, but most of the time they're not. And even if they are, what does it matter? Like, I remember kids in school thinking that, like, oh, they're talking about me. It's like this very narcissistic, paranoid way of thinking. And that's almost worse than talking just flat shit. I mean, most talking shit is funny. It does bring laughs out. But, you know, people, you know, they're less concerned about people simply talking about them and more concerned with, like, people laughing at them. Oh. To the point where, like, they'll manufacture that in their heads. Oh, I saw them over there. They were laughing, and then they kind of looked at me. They're talking about me. Fuck them. I'm going to fucking kill. It's like a school shooter mentality. They're all laughing at me. And when people do actually laugh at you, like, that's, like, I'm talking about people who are so paranoid, which is many people, that they think people are always laughing at them. But then there's the fact that people do laugh at you sometimes, and that'll really send someone overboard. Like, if you've ever been hanging out with friends and, like, your friends are making fun of you and laughing, it's like, oh. Every laugh is like acid being thrown in your face. And so, you know, on that level, we're very, as much as we seek humor and love humor, we're also terrified of humor. Terrified of humor at our expense. And then, so, you know, you map that out, or you know, expand that out to politics and social issues. And the way people are about humor these days, the way people react to humor these days, is almost like that paranoid person, except instead of being paranoid about people laughing at them, they're paranoid about people laughing at things that are sacred to them. Laughing at things that they feel, you know, need to be protected. You know, and so that leads to just a general, like, anti-humor mentality. And the funny thing about humor is it's often not even that funny. It's just something people kind of do. Like, I think about things sometimes that will make me laugh on a daily basis. And if I revisited that, it's not like I'd be like, man, that's funny. But it's just kind of how you know, it's how you get through moments. It's just like, let's turn this into something funny. In the grand scheme of things, like, tomorrow, this might not sound very funny. It's why, like, you had to be there is a thing. Because, like, something happened, you were talking to people, and something funny happened, you were all laughing, and then you try to relay that to somebody else, and you really did have to be there. You had to be one of the people who was there killing time with humor in that moment. And so it doesn't translate to a story very well. You know, and so it's not even that humor has to be that funny. It's just something that's kind of necessary. And, you know, I was talking about how, you know, it feels like the idea of, like, leaving reviews and ratings and stuff online is more of a feminine tendency today. You know, this isn't directly related to that, but it's just kind of one of those differences I've noticed with men and women. Is that when a group of men meet up, they kind of, they immediately start doing and saying things to try to make each other laugh. Maybe not even that heavy-handed. They just, the smallest thing. Like, if you see a group of guys, like, who plan to get together, and they all meet up at the same place, you know, within seconds, like, somebody's laughing and, you know, saying, talking some shit, and, like, someone's kind of, like, doubling over in laughter. It's something that men just start doing immediately. You just meet up, oh, let's talk shit and joke about something. And it might not even be like a real joke. It's just kind of like, oh, hey, you're walking up over here like you're going to rob me. I don't know. Not very funny. But guys will just start talking shit and joking. And I think the version of that that women do, it's not jokes. Like, they don't just like walk. Like, when a group of women convenes, they don't just immediately start cracking jokes. What they might do is they might start talking gossip. You know, because that's their entertainment. Like, entertainment for men is like just busting balls, joking around, talking shit. With women, it's more like, oh, did you hear this? And when I say gossip, I don't even mean that to sound bad. Like, everybody gossips. I like gossip. You know, if you came up with a different word for gossip, you know, and thought about it a little differently, it wouldn't have that connotation it does. But gossip is the word for it. And when a group of women meets up, that's generally what they do. Like, I remember when I was in college, I think I had just graduated, but my girlfriend at the time was in college, and like her coworker's boyfriend was one of these white guys with dreadlocks that sold me weed. And so I would buy weed from him. And one time they were having a party though, and we went, like, we didn't typically socialize with these people, but we went over to their house, and I really didn't experience the college experience at all. And this is like very much like, it wasn't a huge party or anything, but it was a party. And so I just hung out with these guys. Like, my girlfriend was like, you go hang out with the guys, I'll go hang out with the women. And I didn't know any of these guys, and we were smoking a bunch of weed, so I just didn't have anything to say. I'm just like, if I'm high around strangers, I'm just not going to have much to say. But we were pretty much just like talking shit immediately. Like, there's one guy, this weird older guy was there who was, like, addicted to nitrous. And he's like, see this? He's like, I keep like, my nitrous. And he had, like, this hard plastic, like, weed container that was airtight. And he's like, I put these in a Ziploc bag, and I keep them in the toilet tank so my wife doesn't find them. And he was talking about, how, like, and he started taking nitrous hits right there, and we were just sort of, like, laughing at him. And then, like, this weird little, this skinny little redheaded Jewish white rapper, he was there, and he was, like, telling us about something at the college called the Hip Hop Congress. And so right away, I'm just laughing. I'm just like, what the? Because the kid was, like, totally sincere about it. He was talking about, like, a meeting of the Hip Hop Congress at the college. And then the weed dealer, who was the only one I knew at all, as the little, you know, redheaded Jewish kid was telling us about the Hip Hop Congress, like, the dreadlocked drug dealer just kept turning to me and being like, it's all a bunch of bullshit, like, it's all white boys, like, it's fucking stupid, like, just in front of the kid. And so I'm just, like, laughing. Like, he's just talking shit about the hip-hop this kid's, like, stupid hip-hop congress. Which, what do they even do? It's, like, a small group of kids who like hip-hop, who make hip-hop at the college, like, meet up to make decisions. To do what? What do you even do at meetings of the hip-hop congress? You promote each other? Like, what the fuck are you doing? But, like, I just remember, though, that, like, just the men's table, and they were playing, like, poker, too, or something. These are just, like, a bunch of hippie, you know, these are just like a bunch of typical like liberal arts college students, and they're just like playing poker, talking shit. This guy's making fun of the Hip Hop Congress. Like, this guy's like telling us about like hiding nitrous in his toilet tank so his wife doesn't find it. And then he starts taking nitrous hits at the table, and we're just laughing. Just, it's ridiculous. And then I remember kind of like reconvening with my girlfriend, and they were just like, the girls were just like standing in a hallway in like a small circle, just being like, yeah, did you hear this? Oh, did you hear this? Did you hear what she? And I was like, oh, this is so perfect. This is so perfect, because it's like the girls split off, and like what they're doing is they're just telling story. They're telling real life soap operas, and the men are just, it's just ridiculous. We're just making fun of each other and laughing. And that just plays out, you know, all the time. You know, women joke. Like, you know, you say that and it's like, oh, there's women who joke around. But it's just like when women meet up with other women, they don't just start doing that. They don't just start, like, riffing and joking. And it might not even be anything funny. Most men aren't very funny at all. But they kind of start to create that atmosphere where you can just kind of laugh and make fun. And this is, you want to hear something ridiculous? And, you know, and I bet if I was a woman, I would love those little, I would love to meet up other women and just be like, did you hear this? Did you hear what she did? Because I'm someone who doesn't think there's like anything inherently wrong with that. You know, in pointing that out, it would sound like it's a criticism of women, but it's not. I'm not criticizing women. I'm just saying that's more of the tendency. You know, and I just remember that particular moment because I was pretty young. I was probably like 23. And I was really stoned at a place I was uncomfortable being at. Like being at this party of, you know, 20-year-old liberal arts students. It's just, I'm not going to, and I'm really high. With people I don't know anybody there. I know the drug dealer more than I know anybody there, and I barely know him. But I just remember thinking, like, you know, I feel really uncomfortable. and because of that, being extra aware of everything that was going on. And sure enough, though, and it was weird, too, because it was like the only party I ever remember going to with my girlfriend where she was like, you go hang out with the boys and I'm going to go talk to the girls. You know, it was segregated. It was like the girls part of the house and the boys part of the house. And because she was kind of my lifeline to these people, like she knew a couple of the people there better than I did. I knew nobody. You know, so I'm in this weird position where it's like, you're my lifeline to these people and you're abandoning me. But, you know, something natural was playing out. Something natural was playing out where the women went off, these 20-year-old girls at Evergreen State College, like they went off to go tell their stories to each other, and the men just kind of sat around bullshitting, cracking. Seen that play out a million times since, but that was just a moment where I was like, oh yeah, this is how things work. This is how it works. And you'll see that too, you know, you'll see, like, I don't know, I was watching these interviews the last couple nights with Crips, old Crips, old crippled people, no, like old, like members of the Crip gang. Guys who were, you know, members of the Crips in the 70s and 80s. And so it's guys who just have spent their entire lives just hanging out on the street corner. And like when one of them walks up to each other, like within seconds, they're just like cracking jokes. And these are black guys. So like all of a sudden there's very exaggerated laughter, doubled over and, you know, bent over laughing. About nothing in particular, too. And that's how it is when I meet up with my friends. We're just like Crips. No, when I meet up with my friends, that's how it's always been too. Like you meet up with each other and like within seconds, You're like, what's up? And then within seconds, it's like somebody's like, oh, listen to this. Somebody's making a joke. Get a load of this. And humor is obviously a much more male tendency. I've seen this happen over and over and over again. Like, let's say you're like sitting at a table in a bar, a mixed group, a nice co-ed group of men and women. Like one of the men at the table, like you start drinking and like one of the guys at the table, he'll like make a joke and then another guy kind of plays off that. And then before you know it, it's a table of just men telling jokes. Like people are telling stories and then, and you know, a guy's bouncing some joke off of that. You're doing it. And like women will joke and play into it, but it's very male dominated. And, you know, it goes into like what Christopher Hitchens wrote years ago. He wrote that essay called like Why Women Aren't Funny, which is meant to be provocative. You know, it's meant, Christopher Hitchens was purposely incendiary. So it's obviously purposely provocative. PP. It's a PP. It's a triple P, a purposely provocative piece. It's a PP. It's a PPP. But yeah, it gets into it. It goes deep though, you know. He says in that, it's like the only funny women you'll really come across, they're either fat or they're Jewish. But he talks about how it's kind of an evolutionary thing, how, you know, if a guy is not attractive, you know, what does he have available to him to make women want to be around him? And one of those is humor, and women love humor. And he makes the point in that too. He's like, how many times have you been listening to a woman talk about the new guy she's dating, and she's like, you know, she might have a whole bunch of other things she likes about him, but one of the main things she'll point out is like, and he's so funny too. And I think he even says, like, even if you've met him and you know this guy isn't funny at all, part of the attraction is that she finds him funny. And then he makes the point that how many times have you been talking to a guy about some new girl he's seeing, and he says, yeah, and she's so funny too. Of course, I've dated funny people. Like, I mean, you know, again, it's not, the point isn't that women are just not funny. It's that, you know, that it's not a trait that the other sex really looks for. Men aren't really looking for that in women. And it's not something that women really display that prominently either. A lot of women. So you're not going to hear very many guys who, you know, they might have a whole list of things they like about her, but saying humor, you know, saying that her sense of humor is one of the reasons he likes her is pretty rare. And, you know, my own take on that, like my own, what I would insert into that is that in my experience, women are much better with inside jokes. Like, men can sit down at a table and just immediately start riffing. Like, men are the masters of inside jokes, too. But, like, you can riff about anything and everything. It's very aggressive the way that men go about humor. Whereas, like, a girlfriend you're dating or somebody, like, you kind of quietly develop secret jokes between you. And the woman will often be very funny, very original. But it's much more of this personal exchange, not something that's just thrown out there. And, you know, so Christopher Hitchens, you know, again, it was meant to be provocative. It's simply called Why Women Aren't Funny. But he makes good points in there about why that might be. Like, and I think the bigger point he's making, it's not saying women just aren't funny. It's that it's not part of the female identity as much, period. And it's, you know, over time, it was obviously a way for men to attract women when they might not otherwise be able to. and it keeps women with a man as well. It's not just that it attracts her to him initially, it's that that'll actually keep a woman with a man if he's able to make her laugh continually. Like, even a guy who she might otherwise find attractive for other reasons, she's going to be more likely to like him more to begin with and stay with him if he's able to make her laugh. So there's something about the man needing to be able to do that. And Christopher Hitchens talked about how, you know, it is like battle. And something that will really humiliate, something that's emasculating to a man, is if he's at a table of men and he's the least funny one there. Or if he's simply less funny than another guy. A man can feel emasculated by that. Like, oh, nobody laughs at my jokes. And I think emasculating is the right word for it. Because it's a very, because humor and joking and, you know, aggressive humor, putting it out there, is a very masculine sort of energy. So if you're not able to do that, it is a masculine quality you don't have. And even if it, and it's not even about whether it's truly witty or funny, it's just simply the ability to do it, to riff, especially in that moment. You know, it's why some people get kind of tricked into thinking they could be professional comedians. You know, a lot of, I've seen open mic stand-up. I've never seen a professional stand-up comedy show, but I've seen some open mics and things like that. And you see the people up there and you're like, who told this person they thought they could, who told this person that they should do this? You know, and it's not just that they're new to the stand-up comedy format. Like, there's a lot of people where you're just like, this person shouldn't even be trying. You know, maybe this person can kind of riff with their friends, but that doesn't translate to actually presenting it to an audience. And so someone can be funny, you know, circumstantially funny. Like, when they're out at a bar with friends, they might say some funny things in context with the conversation, but the idea of like presenting that on its own just isn't going to be funny. And so I think sometimes people make that mistake where they're like, oh, I should do this. I should try this out. I should try to be a capital F funny guy. I should try to be known for my humor. Whereas it's like, no, you're probably only funny in circumstantial situations with your friends. And that's something that, you know, podcasting has revealed, you know, given that, you know, some of the biggest podcasts in the world since it started have been professional comedians, people who make a living by being funny. You see who's actually funny in the moment and who isn't. You know, you'll see some people on podcasts and you're like, this guy's truly funny in conversation. And you'll see other people where, like, they can write out humor that makes people laugh on stage, but you can see in a conversation, they really aren't that funny of a person. Funnier than the average person, like, they can kind of riff and quip, but nothing they're saying would make you think, oh man, this guy's fucking funny, dude. You know, nothing makes you think, like, this person's particularly funny. They just kind of know how to, like, tap into the mood of the conversation and make a few jokes. And so that's what been one interesting thing about it, is you get to see which comedians are actually funny or not. You know, I think I've mentioned this before, but, you know, Joe Rogan is, you know, a professional comedian, a huge one, and I like him. I like Joe Rogan. But he's not that funny of a person. If you watch his show, like, he's fun. And I think that's what I'm getting at. It's a difference between fun, being fun, and being funny. Like, Joe Rogan's fun. He can have fun conversations with people, but he doesn't usually say things that make you laugh, that make me laugh. You know, the extent of his humor tends to be just like, you know, did you see that monkey's dick? It was this long. You know, it's pretty simple like that. And it's fun. Like, if you were having a conversation with a guy like Joe Rogan, you'd be like, this guy's funny, he's fun. But, you know, it's in contrast to these other people you'll see on podcasts where you're like, oh no, this guy's really fucking funny. This guy can really get into it. This guy can really, like, touch that funny nerve. That funny nerve. This guy can really do that. But all these people are professional comedians. All these people are funny people. They're professional funny men. It's just that there's a difference. Some people are funny, some people aren't. Some people are simply fun. And humor is one of those things. You know, I was talking about how people are terrified of it on an individual level. Like, oh, people are making fun of me. People are laughing at me. And then you extrapolate that out to politics, where it becomes like people are laughing at this thing that's inappropriate. People are laughing at this thing that hurts people. People are laughing at this thing they shouldn't be laughing at. You know, it's politics. Religions, obviously, you know, religious societies are terrible when it comes to that, at trying to stop people from laughing at certain things. But we can see where, you know, progressive politics have really made that their own in recent years, trying to stop people from laughing at things. It's once again a very cynical and paranoid reaction to humor. And but another way that what was I going to say? The other side of Batty. Hey, don't. You see, he always does this when I'm doing podcasts. He's always trying to sleep when I'm doing this, and I'll just like move my arm slightly, and he freaks out on me. But what I was going to say is, like, another negative. Another way that, like, people, you know, react very negatively to humor is if something's simply not funny at all. Not whether they're offended by it, not whether it hurts them personally, not whether they think it hurts some bigger issue they care about. It's when it's simply not funny at all. It's like bad music. It's like there's something viscerally offensive to you about it. It's not just, oh, that wasn't funny, let's move on. It's like, oh. And you get that feeling if you've ever seen open mics. Like, I think I've seen two comedy open mics. Like, one night, I was really fucked up, and my ex-girlfriend was like, oh, my friend, who was also a woman, is doing an open mic stand-up set. You should meet me there. And so I went, and it was just so painful. It was so painful. And it was very political too. This is Olympia, downtown Olympia, so it was very politicized. Everything people said was very politicized. And it, just for me though, I was like, oh. You know, it's different from like hearing somebody talk and just not being interested in it. When someone's trying to be funny but they're not succeeding, you feel it on this deep level. You know, it shakes you down to your bones, shakes you in your gut. You know, it's almost like a bad smell. It's like, oh, that smells awful. Oh, I gotta get out of here. You know, you feel it on that level. And bad music is that way too. When music really bothers you, it really fucking bothers you. And music and humor are two of those things that you live for. Like something making you laugh out loud, or music that you truly love. You know, nothing is better than that, and that's a high that we're looking for all the time. But when something does the opposite, you know, it shakes you on the deepest level. And you almost want to kill the person. Like, when someone's truly unfunny, you know, you almost want to kill them. Not that I actually have bloodlust, but it's almost like, Jesus, somebody get rid of this guy. Get out of here. Bad music, too. Like, get this Melkor out of here. Who does this guy think he is? Get him the fuck out of here. Just get him out of here. You know, you hate it. It's hatred that you feel. Also, embarrassment. You feel deeply and truly embarrassed for this person. Oh, this guy tried to make a joke and nobody laughed. Or even if people do laugh and you didn't laugh, you're just like, I hate this guy. But you're also just, you feel bad. You feel deeply embarrassed. More than you would if somebody was trying to do something else and failing. Like if someone was trying to ride a bike and fell over, you know, it might be kind of like a, you might get like a blooper laugh out of you. Ha ha. But and it might be a little bit embarrassing, but it's like you're not going to feel it on a very deep level. It's just like, oh, that guy was trying to ride a bike and he fell over. Huh. That sucks. Sucks for him. But when it's humor or, you know, music in particular, you know, it's just, it's just like, oh my God. Huh. You feel it. But, you know, so it's interesting, this thing that it is what we all live for. Humor is very much what we live for. I'm always looking for humor. I'm always looking for fun. I think a lot of people would say I'm not that much fun, but like I'm always looking for something funny. Like when I go out in the world, like even if I just go to the grocery store, I'm like, I'd like to see something funny today. I'd like something funny to come out of all this. If I'm having a conversation, like I hope this goes in a direction that's funny. But that it's also this thing where you're just, I hope people aren't laughing at this. Hope people aren't laughing at me. I hope someone doesn't try to be funny, but they're not funny, because I'm going to hate it. It's this thing that has all of this negativity attached to it. But the pursuit of the real thing, something truly funny, is what's worth living for. So you're willing to put up with all of this weird dread and failure and unfunniness just to occasionally find something funny, which I find interesting. But I don't know. I started out talking about reviews, turned to humor, the sort of anti-humor that's been a part of things, the way that, you know, what tied those together was that, you know, people's reaction to certain humor is very ideologically driven. And so people will review things based on that. People will review comedy that way. They will criticize comedy, not for whether it's inventive or does something to actually generate humor. It'll be judged just for, oh, what are they saying? You know, and how does what they're saying, you know, play into this thing I care about? And people will try to actually censor humor or give humor a negative review for that reason as well. But the nice thing is, like, you cannot stop humor. Like, people will find a way to find humor in every situation. And in many ways, it needs a certain amount of censorship. It needs to be suppressed a little bit, because that's what makes people more inventive. You know, because if there wasn't any danger to true humor, it would all just be like Cards Against Humanity crap, where it's just like a really safe way of being offensive. Like, if everybody was just telling the same offensive jokes all the time, they wouldn't even be that funny. And I'm not into just pure shock humor. Like, somebody simply saying something offensive just to be offensive isn't funny to me. Maybe when I was a teenager, but as an adult, like, it's just not funny to me. It better be inventive. I like things that offend or shock, but it's not simply because they offend or shock. There has to be something to it. And what's nice is that, like, when some humor isn't allowed, people get even more creative with it. And so that balance is always key, where it's not just like, oh, I wish that there was no repression or censorship or anything, and people could just say whatever they want all the time. Yeah, that'd be nice in some ways. You wouldn't have to worry about saying the wrong thing. But worrying about saying the wrong thing
helps people create more inventive and creative ways to say the wrong thing. And in being creative and inventive, it's that much funnier. And so you always want that balance. You know, I look at music that way as well. Like, you know, a lot of music in recent decades, you know, has this spirit of rebellion. And it's hard to do that. It's hard to create subversive music when there's total censorship or there's nobody supporting you. But it's even harder to create subversive music when it's like your parents are like, oh yeah, you should, we love your punk band. We're, you know what, we're going to buy you all your instruments and, you know, we love your punk band, son. And, you know, you're not up against anything. Society's just like, yeah, punk is cool. Oh, that's great that you're saying that. That's great that you're doing that. Like, that doesn't create the right environment for something creative and inventive to have too much support. But too little support, or, you know, when it verges into just flat out censorship, like, you know, if that goes too far, that's a problem too. So I think all of these things are about kind of maintaining that balance between, you don't want the world to support you too much, because you, I think, no, like, fighting against something doesn't just create kind of an energy, but it also, like, when there's pushback against you, it also causes you to be more inventive and creative. And so no matter what you're doing, I think that's important. Total acceptance and total support doesn't really work. Doesn't really create the environment you need to do something special. But then you don't want to be, you know, having your life ruined because you said or did something wrong. You know, you don't want to have the government banning the music you make. So having that balance between, like, just enough openness and just enough pushback, just enough suppression to keep you strong, to keep you pushing, you know, that's very important in all this. And, you know, with the anti-humor trend of the last decade or so, I've seen people get more inventive, and there's some very funny people out there. They operate on the fringes, but that's the best place to be. And so in a funny way, like an anti-humor era actually creates great humor. While it's going on, you might be like, man, I wish society would lighten up a little bit, but you don't want them to lighten up too much either. Just interesting how that works.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave, this golden land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, I see a land where children can run free.